Campus FM presents a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum entitled The Roman Ship at Schlendi, 1961-2011. This talk is delivered by Professor John Woods.
Welcome to another lecture organized by Palazzo Falson, this time on underwater archaeology. We are fortunate in having Professor Woods address today's lecture. Professor John Woods is known internationally due to his expertise in oceanography, for which he has held the professorial chairs in Southampton, Kiel and London. He founded the UK National Oceanographic Centre at Southampton, and his research has focused on the physics of the upper ocean and on theoretical plankton ecology. He is Emeritus Professor of Oceanography and Complex Systems at Imperial College London. He has played a key role in establishing the contribution that the ocean makes to climate change. He promoted these ideas through membership of international committees, including the World Climate Research Programme, the World Ocean Circulation Experiment, which he co-chaired, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for which he shared in the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize for Climate Change. 50 years ago, John Woods led the project to survey the Schlendi Roman wreck. He had a blue-chip team of advisors, including the world-renowned marine archaeologist Joan Duplat Taylor, the director of archaeology at the Malta National Museum, David Trump, and Captain Olof Frederick Golscher. Professor Woods will today recount the story of the Schlendi wreck, setting it in its historical and archaeological context. Today's lecture is actually very closely connected to a particular aspect of Captain Golscher's life. Captain Golscher, of course, owned what is today Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum. He became interested and very involved in underwater archaeology in the very late 50s and the early 60s. In fact, he passed away in 1962. And it is particularly apt that 50 years on, we recall his pioneering initiatives in this area, particularly through the eyes of people who met and worked closely with him. Before I pass on the word to Professor Woods, I will ask Mr. John Wood, whose name is very close to Professor Woods, who has been instrumental in helping to organize this lecture and was himself part of the team diving the wreck, to give us a brief and personal account of what triggered off the 1961 expedition. So, John.
It isn't often that one is in the right place at the right time. I was lucky enough to be in Malta with the Royal Navy in the summer of 1961, the perfect time and place to learn to dive. With several like-minded colleagues who wanted to do something with our new skill, we formed an Outward Bound Association and were delighted to accept an invitation to do archaeology with the French Navy in Tunisia. Our departure date for this mission arrived without the necessary diplomatic clearance. And so Captain Sutton, commander of the Naval Air Station at Halfar, rather than waste an opportunity, ordered us to Gozo to search harbours and bays under the direction of the Department of Antiquities. Director of Antiquities, Tancred Gouda, asked his colleague Mr. Massini to direct our undersea endeavours. At first, we explored Ramla Bay, but without success, and as consolation, sought an octopus for supper in Schlendi Bay. That evening we found our fish supper and, in the process, found amphora in abundance at the foot of a rock awash in the harbour mouth. We were not the first to find treasures. In the early 20th century, Greek sponge divers wearing cumbersome brass helmets and lead shoes had discovered spectacular statues at Mardia and Antikythera, artifacts which were recovered in salvage operations. But in June 1961, we were aware of Jacques Cousteau, the pioneer of free diving, owner of the old Gozo ferry, Calypso, and of the work he and his associates were doing to develop method in a nascent discipline. We were desperate to do the right thing, but without the means or training. By amazing coincidence, John Woods and his team from Imperial College were already on the island pursuing similar objectives. Their timely and generous contribution with professional skills outside our experience ensured that the site was properly recorded for posterity. And he, of course, is best qualified to explain. John.
Well, thank you very much, John. It's wonderful to be introduced by an old friend from 50 years ago, and we've been in touch since. Back in Malta, after 50 years, and this map was made just after Valletta. You can see it in red there. And of course, you can see Imdina in red as well. Coming back for me is a great joy. I spent many years of my life in Malta in the 60s and early 70s, coming out each summer to do research. And of course, like many people, I fell in love with the Maltese and with the island. It's for me, this is just pure nostalgia, so excuse me if I have a little sob occasionally. I'd like to start by thanking Francesca for organizing the evening. She's been a ball of fire, and golly, she her only failing is to be not provide enough seats. Sorry about that. Thank you very much, Francesca. Thank you for your kind words of introduction. 50 years ago, well, a few people in the audience perhaps can remember it, but let me set the scene. The Beatles had just cut their first record. The Jaguar had just launched the E-Type as its rival to Ferrari. It didn't quite manage that, but Yuri Gagarin had just been launched as the first man into space. Now, the next one may surprise you. Barack Obama was born. And finally, I mean, this is on this short list, Italy was celebrating the centenary of its unification. And I'll come back to that later, because that actually played a rather crucial part in the expedition. I'm going to show a lot of slides. And please don't snore. I mean, if you want to go to sleep. And I should say, 90% of the pictures I took myself, there are a few that I didn't, and you can tell those because I'm in the picture. I gave the camera to somebody else. My main point is that the pictures were taken 50 years ago. And they've been moving around house from house as I moved family home. They've been stored in lofts, in garages, and they're not in ideal condition. So my first task was to take them out of the glass mounts, clean them up, and you can go on cleaning up slides forever, and after a bit it becomes artificial. So please, I apologize for the fact they're dusty and they've got scratches, and they're 50 years old. I'm pretty sure that 50 years from now, my grandson won't be able to look at the digital slides I'm taking now, because the computers in 50 years from now won't be able to read them. So thank you, Kodachrome, for producing a method that we can still use today. Well, continuing 50 years ago, let me move to Malta and set the scene. It was rare even then to see sailing fishing boats. I contacted Joe Barbara, who was the National Fisheries Officer, and he said he thought there might still be one fisherman who had the sails in the loft somewhere. And sure enough, Simon of Marsaschlock produced the sails, and here he is teaching us how to sail this boat. And we entered it for a regatta. The regatta was with the RAF and the Navy, and they had much faster boats. But you'll see there's a wake here. We were getting up speed. So we had an honorable entry, and I think this was perhaps the last time that a fishing boat with sails entered into a regatta. But maybe somebody here can tell me that I'm wrong. It was great fun. Now a few words about the expedition. This is a terrible group picture, but it shows the diving team that I brought out from Imperial College in London. I had just graduated in physics, and three engineers, two other physicists, a zoologist, and a botanist in the team. So we were students, and we were all passionate about diving. And we thought we should have an expedition. And we talked about it and decided the expedition should be concerned some way with marine archaeology. And so luckily in London there is the Institute of Archaeology, and one of the staff, Joan Duplat Taylor, had got the marine archaeology bug. And she later became world famous. She was the great professional in marine archaeology, and she took over and said, right, this is where you're going to go, this is what you're going to do, I'll make contacts for you. And I dreamt of going to some exotic island, and she said, no, go to Malta, because it's well organized, everything's there, you won't waste time on logistics and getting to know people, you'll have all the contacts, the museum. One of her ex-students, David Trump, was director of archaeology at the museum, and she introduced me to him, I was writing to him, and she introduced me to Olli Golcher. And that was the start of a long friendship. He was marvelous. He made the Norman House our planning center. We used to have meetings there with everybody. Any time we wanted to have support from somebody, he'd say, oh, I'll organize a meeting. And these people turned up and they said yes, because he had this magic, both in personality, but also he was so much respected on the island. So again, thanks to Joan Duplat Taylor, she had a friend who was the director of Martini Rossi in London. Now, Martini Rossi in Italy was celebrating the centenary of the unification of Italy by converting their first factory, the place where they'd made their first wine, into the National Museum for Wine. And Major Covington, the director in London, said, well, wouldn't it be wonderful? We'll fund this expedition, and they might find some old wine jars. That's a pretty long shot. He said, we'll pay for it. And all through these contacts from this marvelous woman. Anyway, jumping ahead, I was very happy in September that year, in 61, to take an amphora from Schlendi and present it to the museum in Turin, the Martini Rossi Museum in Turin. It's there as a prize exhibit, so anybody can see. And there we are, that's from Schlendi. So we had funding, we had wonderful contacts, and through these contacts, the Royal Air Force provided what was the vital resource for any diving team, air. Oh, I'm sorry. That was, you know, we were dreaming of archaeology. This is just a mood-setting picture. This is not a Roman ship. This is a 20th century Maltese fishing boat near Ruidisera. And here we were. We were practicing. The Royal Air Force provided air. Any diver knows that if you don't have compressed air in abundance to fill your aqualung tanks, you're not in the business. And so this was fantastic. They also provided somewhere for us to live in Califrana. Okay. We had an expedition, we had the people, we had money, we had air, we had somewhere to live. I now want to jump, because we knew, we had heard, but hadn't yet met, John Wood, and his colleagues in the Navy, but we had seen photographs of some of the amphorae that they were bringing up from Schlendi. And this was causing interest amongst archaeologists in London. And they were identified as being 3rd century BC, late 3rd century BC. And with hindsight, we can see now what the period was, what was going on. We're talking about the Second Punic War, or the Romans called it the War Against Hannibal, 218-202. This was the time that the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, who had been in Malta, were overpowered by the invading Romans, who took over and used the fortresses and defenses of Malta and Gozum. Hannibal, of course, famously had invaded Italy. So here we are, Carthage. He'd gone the long way round, come over the Alps with his elephants, and was romping around in Italy, and the Roman armies could not beat him. He won battle after battle after battle, and this posed an enormous problem for the Romans. And the Senate decided that the answer was to cut his supply line, because he was relying on supplies from home. He wasn't living off the land. And so the Roman fleet was sent down using its new base in Malta and base in Sicily, and it defeated the Carthaginian fleet, which was master of the central Mediterranean in those days, and changed the whole situation. It changed it not only for military reasons, but also for merchant shipping and trade, because trade had pretty well frozen in the Mediterranean. Merchant ships encountered Carthaginian ships, which were called pirates by definition, because they're the other side. And so everything had stopped. The Roman fleet took control of the Mediterranean, and trade began again. And we'll see that that is a vital part of the story. The ship that sank at Shendi looked a bit like this museum model, a very small boat, probably a cargo of not more than 50 tons in an open hold. A crew, just a small crew of half a dozen people, perhaps. If you want to get an idea of what that would look like today, about that size, motor fishing vessel. In fact, this is one that we were using for diving. You can see the safety boat here. You can see the bubbles of the divers here. The safety man's looking in completely the wrong direction. So that sets the scene. We're talking about 22 centuries ago, well before St. Paul. John has described how, due to a series of happy circumstances, he and his colleagues discovered the ship, or the wreckage, at Shlendi. And we met him and his colleagues, and they were extremely generous. They said, "Join us. Come in. See what we've found. Come diving with us." And so my first, what I call chapter two, is going to be about the days when we were diving with the Royal Navy in Shlendi. Now, John is an aircraft engineer. Would that be? He was servicing helicopters at Halfar. We were living in Califrana at the Marine Craft Unit, and Shlendi, of course, is inconveniently right up the other end. And to dive there, we had to go round. Here is our first meeting at the quayside in Califrana. There's John, who opened the door. That's me, very much younger. And here's the boat that we were going to use, and he had organized for four of us to join him to visit the site. Here we are coming along the cliffs, the four-hour trip from one end of the island to the other. And if I remember correctly, I've forgotten his name. Hervin. He had a coxswain's ticket, so he was allowed to drive the boat. And the others were all aero engineers. They could service helicopters, but they weren't allowed to drive the boat. He was vital. So here we are in Shlendi. This is a picture I took from a helicopter, looking into the creek, and you can see a little bit more clearly from the boat. Here's the St. Patrick's Hotel. Here's the police station flying the flag. There's the church here. It's a little bit different now, I'm told, but next week I'm going to find out. So that was Shendi in 1961. First thing we did, this is, remember, we were traveling out with the guests of the Navy, was to camp. They camped in a quarry, just, this is Spanish Point, they were camped just off Spanish Point. You can see the tower, Torre Ishlendi, is that right? The headland is Ras Il Baida, if I get the pronunciation right. And it was off that headland that the ship had sank. So we camped, and being with the Navy, we had a full naval breakfast. You don't dive without lots of food in you. And here we are, coming down the steps at Shendi, on the south side of the creek, getting on board. You can imagine, 22 centuries earlier, a boat about the same size there, bringing supplies to the Roman garrison, which was occupying the recently captured Phoenician, Carthaginian fort on the headland. In fact, David Trump and his team of archaeologists had been excavating the Phoenician fortification, the Punic fortifications, just when we were there. And so everything was so alive, we could imagine the Roman garrison up there, ship coming in, bringing supplies to them. Here's the poor coxswain. He was the sort of general dog's body on the team. If something needed doing, like filling the aqualung tanks with air, he did it. There's nodding from John. He remembers it well. One of the very important things I mentioned earlier for any diving is you have to have compressed air. Now, this boat was large enough to have 5 big cylinders of air, which would do us for 4 days diving. From the large cylinders, the air is passed to the small aqualungs for the divers, and that's what's going on here. Now, I'm just going to show a few shots of the Navy divers. Here they are. They're bringing up fragments of amphorae. They're quite light, and you can lift those and swim up with them quite easily, because when you go down, your aqualung tanks are full of air and quite heavy. But when you've been down there some time, you've breathed all the air, the tanks are light, and you compensate with the extra weight of the amphora, and you can still swim up. So, I mean, these practical things. I think the diver on the right is wearing a ship's diver's navy outfit. And here they are, coming up to the surface, bringing samples. But if one wanted to raise a complete amphora, a wine jar, it was very heavy. Heavy not only because it was complete, but it was full of sand. It was down at the bottom, sand had filtered, and it was quite difficult to lift it. And so we had buoyancy bags which were filled with air from the aqualung. You just open the tank and air rushes into them, and up the whole thing goes to the surface. And it's like a lift, marvelous. This shot shows what happened. When the bags get to the top, a snorkeler would come down and push the amphora towards the boat. And you can see here, it's absolutely full of sand. And we should see later other things too. And this is a diver's view, looking up from underneath. This is what you see with the buoyancy bags and the rubber boat. This is a Gemini Navy inflatable. And then the artifacts were brought on board, and you can see they're sitting here on the large air cylinders. The next step was to take them ashore and photograph them. So we wanted to record everything that was brought up. Actually, those are the same pots that we've just seen in the last slide. If you look at them, they're the same ones there. And that's the photograph that I was taking. And of course, it's got a foot rule. The archaeologists always wanted us to include a scale. We'll see that sometimes it proved difficult. And then, in the evening, the jars were taken, all the artifacts that were raised were taken to the police station. Why? Because the police station had a lock-up. They went into the cell, and they stayed in the cell, quite safe, locked up, until the curator or director of the Gozo Archaeological Museum could bring a truck down to collect them, which he did from time to time. So the police station was absolutely vital, and here is Peter Warren bringing. He was a big man. He towered over me, and for him, just carrying an amphora was nothing. So that was diving with John Wood and his Navy colleagues, and we did that for 4 weekends in July. Meanwhile, half the team was up with the Navy divers, the other half was down in Marsaschlag searching for cart tracks, these which were run into the sea. David Trump was very enthusiastic. He said, these cart tracks run into the sea, your divers follow them out to sea. Well, unfortunately, there was so much weed and so on, it was a fruitless search, and we were getting more and more frustrated. And we said, right, we're going to go up to Schlendi full time. But that raised some logistic problems. Traveling 4 hours there and 4 hours back every day was going to be too much. So we needed to move base from Califrana up to the north of the island. Ideally, we would have moved to Schlendi itself, but we couldn't get the big gas cylinders there. The RAF provided them, but they couldn't transport them for us to Schlendi. But they could take them to a northern base in Malta, and then we'd go across in a short trip in the boat. Here's our boat. It was too small to carry the cylinders. The Navy boat was very much larger. You can see, I think that's Filfler there, isn't it, in the background. Here's one of our team, a botanist, doing some botany on the side. Here is Ollie Golcher. This is in 1961, and here he is on our diving boat in Schlendi, holding up an amphora, the fragment of the neck. Unusually, it has three handles. I am not an archaeologist. I don't know how common they were. I don't even know if that particular one was part of the Roman ship or maybe some other lost amphora or wine jar. We need some serious analysis, which hasn't been done yet. But he was marvelous. And he said, I'll make you an offer. I have a villa, the Villa Brunswick, in Imjar, in northern Malta. Move up there. You can live in comfort in the villa. There's a Luigi who looked after the villa, will look after you, and use that as your base. And it was a delight. After camping in Califrana on the airfield, this was luxury. The only problem is that the water supply was used for the flowers. So we had to bring in water each day, but from the town. And in fact, here you can see, here's the tank that we filled with water each day, trundle down to the town, fill it with water, bring it back. But the Air Force were marvelous. They delivered the air cylinders to Imjar, so we were able to fill our aqualungs each night. We just orientate ourselves. We kept our diving boat. It's not all that accurate, this map. But this is the ferry station at Marfa. We kept our diving boat there and made the short trip across to Schlendi each day. It took us about half an hour to drive from Imjar to Marfa and then less than an hour across. So much better than trundling all the way around from the south. So our logistics were solved thanks to Ollie Golcher. Marvelous man. And he didn't hesitate. He just said, oh, I have a villa, you can use it. I'll get in touch with Luigi, he'll open it up, he'll do everything for you. This, I think, gives a good view of Schlendi as it was in those days. The St. Patrick's Hotel, the police station, the church, the small fishing port. And here we are with our diving boat and two Navy diving boats on that particular day. We decided we were going to have a month there, August. And what were we going to do with it? We talked, we had planning meetings in the Norman House with Ollie Golcher, David Trump, and others. And we decided that there were two objectives. The first one was to produce a proper survey of the site. Any archaeologist, how many archaeologists are there here? A few? Yes, you're too shy to hold your hands up. Anyway, I was told very firmly at the Institute of Archaeology before we left, the first thing is plan. Get a survey of the site. Until you've done that, you aren't in a position to mark where each artifact comes from, and that may be crucial to putting the whole story together afterwards. So our first objective was a survey. The second objective was in answer to the problem posed by the early collection of artifacts. They were enormously diverse. The Roman ships that had been discovered earlier, and John referred to the Grand Congrès wreck that Cousteau surveyed, they were like supertankers, carrying wine. They started at a vineyard, they had a pottery at the vineyard, they made jars, all identical, and the jars identified the vineyard. It was like Coca-Cola bottles. If you see a Coca-Cola bottle, you know it's Coca-Cola. If you see a, I don't know, what else? Yes, I mean, you recognize instantly the shape of the jar. And it was the same with these wine pots. They stand up about so high. Each vineyard had a pottery with its own brand design. So they would load their ship up. It would tour the Mediterranean, selling the wine at different ports around the Mediterranean, and people knew what they were getting because they had that brand in the brand. The artifacts coming up from the ship were all different designs, so they weren't from the same place. It wasn't a super tanker carrying masses of jars, all with one vintage of wine. It was an absolute mix. And there were jars which were known to be from potteries in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Western Mediterranean, all over. And we couldn't work out why. And we were talking about maybe four or five ships had sank at slightly different times, coming from different places. What David Trump said is, please, I need more samples. Bring up more amphorae from the wreck, but make sure you bring up different ones so that we've got a complete range of the different kinds. Then we'll get some archaeologists to analyze it and work out what on earth was going on. I'll tell the story later. So the first thing was to survey the wreck. We were extremely lucky that we had a professional surveyor with us. He had studied mining at the Royal School of Mines. And amongst other things, they had to survey underground in mine workings. And I was head of that department 40 years later. And they started one side of a mountain. They used a theodolite to step-by-step survey, then down through the mine and pop out where they started. And it had to be accurate to 1 centimeter. Wow, that's professional. So he'd never done any underwater surveying before, but my goodness, he knew surveying. And so with the help of David Trump, he borrowed a plane table. It was the only plane table that the museum had, so they were very trusting. And we set out to survey the reef. Now here is the Navy, the Admiralty chart published just the year before. Here is the tower, the headland, and the reef marked from the point of view, of course, of navigation of ships, not for archaeology, but this is where the ship sank. We had to survey that. Here, looking out, you can see our dive boat. You can see, You can see our inflatable, which has just ferried the surveyor ashore, and here he is walking up past the salt pans to his survey point on the headland. He had two survey points, one on the headland here and one the other side. And what we did is we put a series of markers around the reef, each one with an anchor, a stone which stayed there all summer, probably still there, and a line up to the surface where there was a buoy, which he could see at the plane table. And this is his surveying technique. Here are the 12 markers around the reef. Here's the headland, here's the tower. And from point X and point Y, he used the plane table telescope to say what the direction was. And the intersection of the two gave the position very accurately. So we had marked now the surface area of the reef. The next thing was to go underwater and plot all the details of the reef. Here are a couple of divers. All of these, this is the section at marker 8, and the wreck is down underneath there. And all these details had to be measured. And that was the task of the divers. They had a depth gauge and a measuring rod. And we also used tape measures too. And this was the result. This is a three-dimensional block diagram showing the reef as it would be if you took all the water away. And this is the western end, and the southern side, and it drops in very steep cliffs underwater. You can imagine in the last ice age that was in the air and the sea was much lower, and it would have been quite steep cliffs, just like the cliffs all the way around Schlenthe. And each of these ledges has been measured, so this is not just a fantasy, it is an accurate survey. The wreck itself is here. But scattered all the way round and on the ledges were bits of cargo that had been spilled when the ship sank. So, our first objective, the survey, was complete. Here's the wreck down here. That's a photograph of it. So this is at 60 meters below the surface. The problem was that in the last 2,200 years, there had been a rockfall that had produced some very large boulders, not quite as large as this room, all different sizes, piled on top of the ship. Now, when was that? It was obviously an earthquake. And I have to remind myself from my notes the date of the earthquake. 11th of January, 1693 was the big earthquake. But Pauline Gallier, in 2007 at the university here, published a survey listing all the known earthquakes from recorded records. And so we don't know which one of them it was, but this was the big one. And this is the one that destroyed most of the buildings in Malta and many in Sicily. And the churches were rebuilt, as you know, with a new architectural style called earthquake baroque. So if you talk to an architect and say earthquake baroque, he'll say, oh yeah, that was after the earthquake here. And that's why the churches all look the same. They don't all, I know Mostar's different and so on. But many, many churches were built with exactly that style after that earthquake. And it may have been that earthquake that led to this collapse of material on top of the on top of the reef. And so it was very difficult. The ship was underneath these rocks and we had to sort of feel our way underneath them. And try and find out as much as possible about the ship itself. But most of the material that we brought up had spilled further away and was sitting on the sandy seafloor. A very quick word about diving safety. I was extremely concerned. 60 meters is deep for amateur divers. Most are happy to go to 30 meters. The Royal Navy were permitted to go to 30 meters officially. But, of course, well, we don't say anything. And we followed the British Subaqua Club rules meticulously. I was extremely concerned that I would have to go back and explain how we'd lost a diver, which could have happened. We used dive tables from the United States Navy because they allowed us to dive at 60 meters with stopping to decompress on the way up and then to do the same again 6 hours later. They were the only tables that gave us the chance to dive twice on the same day. And that meant with two pairs, we dived in pairs, so we had six divers on board, so three dives in the morning, then a break, then three in the afternoon. But that wasn't all. We had some new technology. University diving expedition, or expeditions generally, are often given prototypes of equipment to be tested in extreme conditions. This was a breathing apparatus from a company called Normalair, which is famous for making breathing apparatus for firefighters. And they had decided to move into the market of divers, but they didn't know very much about it. But they'd made a breathing apparatus which was unique, that it had absolutely no resistance when you breathed. When you breathe in, with an ordinary aqualung, you have to suck it in, especially when you're deep, when the air's dense. But with this one, you just started to breathe and the air just flooded in, so it was much less tiring, and that was really important at that depth. The next thing is we had an electric tug, which could pull two divers. But we had to go from the surface down to 60 meters. We had to then spend 10 minutes, that's all we were permitted, on the bottom, and then swim 60 meters back. It was very useful to have a lift, and that's what that electric tug did. Again, a prototype, and it worked marvelously. We were still using it 2 years later in Malta. So safety, very important. Everything was to reduce fatigue, to make sure that we reduced air consumption and we stayed fresh and able to work safely at the bottom and return safely to the surface, and do it twice a day. The second objective was to collect artifacts for David Trump and other archaeologists to study. Here we are, back at the bottom. I used to tunnel down in the sand below the rocks, and one could feel amphorae and rose there. The shit's there. And two prize specimens were brought up that way. We actually pulled them out. Remember, we only had 10 minutes to do it, and one's a bit woozy at that depth. But we managed to get it, and here we are bringing up one of the jars. I think something funny's happened here. I seem to have been squashed. As usual, decompressing on the way up, 20 minutes. And 10 minutes on the bottom, 20 minutes before you're allowed then to come to the surface to allow the gases to leave the bloodstream safely. We modified the US Navy tables, dive tables. That sounds outrageous, but we did it safely to allow our zoologist not to do it in midwater, but on the top of the reef, where he could spend 20 minutes searching for his bugs, which was much more effective. It was very boring spending 20 minutes there. After a bit, we came up with a trick. We went to the shop, we bought a couple of plastic shopping baskets, and on the way down, the diver would pop a paperback, a novel he was reading or whatever, into the basket. And then on the way back up, he'd read it for 20 minutes. He'd read a chapter, perhaps. And the time passes wonderfully. Now, we discovered some paperbacks get a bit soggy and others a bit better. Penguins were marvelous. They seemed to have wonderful glue that held the pages together. But that transformed, a stupid thing, but it transformed our whole lives to be able to have read. After a bit, you see, you wanted to finish the chapter and you stayed down longer than you actually had to. So here we are, getting back into the boat at the end of a dive. Shendi in the background, returning the electric tug after he brought the divers back up. Here's our hero, the surveyor, taking his equipment off. We'd made this diving ladder of sort of grown-up Meccano. And here's the zoologist with his modified dive tables. He'd been collecting samples as well as an amphora on his way up. The water, anybody who's been to Schlendi and dive knows how clear the water is there. You can snorkel at the surface, we did, and we could watch the divers 60 meters below us and see what they were doing. It is fantastically clear. Probably there's nowhere in the world as clear. So the divers would attach a rope to one of the complete jars that was to be raised. And from the surface, you could see it. You could follow the line of the rope down with your eye, and you knew what you were bringing up, and you knew that it was going to be a long haul pulling this up. The Navy, of course, had these wonderful lifting bags. We just had a rope. Well, we were students, and they were professionals. And when it came up to the surface, we didn't bring it into the boat because it was very crowded with lots of nasty aqualungs and things. We put it into the rubber boat. This is a prototype rubber boat made by Avon, which they've given us. With each panel has a different kind of fabric and color, so that they were testing. And you can see, here's a collection of jars that's just come. Notice that they're bright red. That's, I don't know, I'm not a zoologist. It's stuff living on them. And it faded after an hour in the air. So you only see it when they've just come up to the surface. The next few slides just show some. You can see also there's enough light down there because of the water so clear for plant life to grow on the jars. You've got seaweed there, actually growing on the jars, as well as this green sort of slime mold or whatever it is. I'm sorry if there's a zoologist in the audience who knows. This one is an important picture. We hadn't got a foot rule, so I used a foot. Some artifacts weren't Roman. This was the weight from a rigging line, which obviously much later. But at the time, you don't know. You bring it up because it's different. You can see the difference in style, obviously from totally different potteries. And these were the two very slender jars that I actually pulled out from under in the sand, underneath the rocks, very gently. But I could feel the two of them there, and I just had to have them. And so up they came. They probably weren't cargo. They were probably for table use, domestic use. We had 4 hours, 6 hours for each pair before they could dive again. And, of course, the first three took 3 hours, and we had then a four-hour wait. And then at the end of the day, we rowed ashore. Here's an anchor, lead anchor, and jars. And Arthur's showing off because the Swedish television is filming him. And, of course, the kids all came round. What were we doing? We were emptying the jars to see what was inside. Now, everybody knew that every ship has one jar with the money. And everybody said to me, have you found the money yet? Unfortunately, we never found the money, but we did discover something which solved the problem of what the cargo was. We found bones and nuts. The ship was carrying a cargo of food. It wasn't full of wine jars full of wine. It was using second-hand jars, which happened to be lying on the port dockside at the port of departure, which had come from all different places. And it used them as waterproof containers for the food that they were bringing to the garrison at Schlendi. So that solved the problem. It wasn't five different boats from different places. It was one boat with jars from different places, second-hand. So here we are at the end of the day. And so, the end of the expedition. I expect people are getting a bit tired now. So, what had we achieved? I think it's fair to say we'd achieved three things. First of all, we were building on the great discovery of John and his colleagues. We had surveyed the site, so we could go back and look the archaeologists in the face. We'd done the right thing. We'd got, I think, really rather a good survey, thanks to Arthur Smith, which still stands as the definitive description of the site. We had brought up a range of pots and an anchor from quite different places. They're now in the Gozo Museum, actually, they haven't yet been analyzed. Sad, 50 years, and nobody has seriously looked at them. It would be wonderful if some young archaeologist in the audience or somebody in Malta would take it on as a project. The good news is that our mentor, Joan Duplat Taylor, who unfortunately died a few years ago, left in her will a legacy to pay for archaeologists to write up the material discovered in Rex. So there's money sitting there to pay for it. So if it might be a wonderful PhD project for somebody. The material is in Gozo, there's a depth of knowledge to research, and there is there's the chance to get the funding for it, which is not easy in archaeology. The funding at the London Institute of Archaeology did not come from the government. It came from the wife of the director. Her name was Agatha Christie. She paid for everything from her books. And it's wonderful. Archaeology is not, it's not like physics where you can get the government to pay for your research. You actually have to find money from Martini Rossi or from Agatha Christie or whatever. But she left a fund which has been invested and earns money which can be spent on writing up material. It's sitting there. I'd love to help somebody get hold of that money and do a good job here. Well, every party, every expedition ends with a party, and we were very happy to invite so many people who had helped us in Malta. It was as if the whole island had rallied round to make sure it worked. And above all, for our sponsor. That was a posed picture, of course. And when we got home, on the way home, we dropped by Torino, we presented them with a jar, and we took two back. These were duplicates that David Trump had selected, so that we weren't taking anything from the collection. And of course, they're still there to be inspected. And this is the rector of Imperial College, and our team, and there's John Wood on the right, Peter Warren behind me, making the presentation. I should say that each of the students has now moved, well, they're retired now, but they've all had a wonderful career. Somehow, the magic of the expedition kick-started the career. It certainly did for me. I was a physicist who ended up in marine science because of this expedition. And many of the others followed equally interesting paths, and I know that John here has continued to work on marine archaeology and still does, I believe. Well, I wanted to just end my talk with two summaries. First of all, let's put together the story as best we can with the present state of knowledge of the Roman ship, its last voyage, sadly. Here is the best reconstruction of a ship of this period. This was a ship from 250 BC that sank in the Thames in London and was excavated by Peter Marsden, and it almost certainly is very good, very similar to the one that sank in Schlendi. The only difference is it was a North European anchor, not a Mediterranean anchor. The Mediterranean anchors were lead. We've heard how the jars suggest that they were secondary use, not primary use. They weren't used to carry wine. They had been collected by the captain. The captain had obviously got a contract to transport supplies to the garrison in Gozo, food and other things. We knew meat was there, we knew nuts were there. Of course, what else? There's many jars still on the seabed waiting to be brought up. Who knows what else we discovered? Maybe the money. So the ship's captain got the contract. He went for his port of departure, collected jars which were to hand on the dockside, which happened to have come from everywhere, but he didn't care. They were waterproof, good, sturdy jars for the cargo. He then set sail for Malta. This was the evidence of his cargo. This is the... These were the jars that we brought up, or actually the first week or so. Each one you see has a label saying exactly where it was found on the survey. And there's the large anchor stock that John found before we arrived. So The cargo had come from all the way around the Mediterranean. We don't know what the port of departure was. We don't have any documents, of course, and came across to Malta, and there encountered rough seas. And the trying to make its way into the creek at Schlendi, it encountered the reef. Now the reef is the ship was much didn't have just a meter or so deep, and the top of the reef is 20 meters deep. So it didn't hit bottom, but the waves on the surface must have just thrown it backwards and forwards until it foundered and bounced its way down the side of the cliff underwater, spilling cargo as it did, until it ended at the bottom, eventually to be covered with the rockfall. To try and prevent that, it had cast out anchors. We found an anchor. John had previously found a larger anchor. So they were throwing out anchors to try and save the boat, but it didn't work. So you can imagine the garrison on the hill fort at Schlendi. Their cargoes are coming in, the letters from their loved ones, food, specialities from home, and they just watch the ship sink in front of their eyes. I think that's disappointing, isn't it? So that's the story that we have. Of course, it's the best story we can piece together on the available evidence so far. Further analysis may force us to change it. Who knows? Finally, the archaeology. We've got the story of the ship. We think we've got it pretty well. What about the archaeology? The archaeologists were... I sent them photographs regularly to London to show them what we were bringing up. And they were getting very excited, not because of the story of the ship, but for another reason. As I explained earlier, each vineyard had its pottery. Each pottery had its style of jar. So this was from the Balearics. That was from Libya, I think, if I remember correctly. I'm only quoting 50-year-old memory, I'm afraid. And so these were taken in the museum before we left, in August 61. Look at this one. This small, with a very pronounced widening of the neck. Obviously, different style entirely. Whoever analyzed them must work out where they were made, when they were made. When they were made is tricky, because the pottery at a particular vineyard would have its standard brand style. But as each potter handed over to his son, the son thought he knew better, and he'd have a little tweak. The design would change a bit. And then the grandson would change it again. So the archaeologists know that although the pot is distinguishable from other sites, it's difficult to nail the exact date. There's this uncertainty because it's changing, and they may have the order, but they don't have the exact dates. And radiocarbon isn't accurate enough to nail it down to 20 years. So this ship is a godsend, because we know that all of these pots were in use that year. They had arrived with wine that year, or the year before, in the port of departure, whichever that was. Syracuse, maybe, I don't know, I'm guessing. And so all of these jars, there's a possibility of a cross-chronology to the slight changes that are going on in all of the different sites, and suddenly they can be locked together. And that is where the archaeologists got very excited. We've got all sorts of other things. Were these the crews, dishes, and so on? We don't know. We can speculate. Here's another collection of bones that were found in this jar. But then we have other material that probably wasn't on the ship, that has just fallen overboard or been dropped over the centuries on the site. Every archaeologist has this problem. You have a site, you're looking for a particular stratum in the site, particular event, but there's other material all mixed up, and this has to be sorted out. This was probably an Arabic jar from much later, medieval perhaps. Where this one came from, heaven knows. This is the one that Oligolcha was holding, the three-handled one, with a sort of water filter there, keep the flies out at the surface. Somebody needs to do research and find out where that came from. Was it the same date or was it much later? And of course, an absolute jumble of bits and pieces. We were told to bring them up, not to just choose the pretty bits, because it's all part of the same story and it has to be unraveled. And there is a lot of material still down there, I understand. So maybe the full analysis needs another expedition to collect more. The world's expert in these jars and their dating and where they came from was Virginia Grace. She worked, here she is as a young woman. Later, after the war, she worked in the American School of Archaeology in Athens, and she systematically went through all of the rubbish tips in Athens using the different strata to give her an idea of dates, and she concentrated specially on some of the jars that were stamped with a name. And they were easily identifiable. But then by association, the ones that weren't stamped but which had the same design, she built up this whole story. And she looked at the photographs of this material and was the one who said, look, we've got a chance here of tying down dates. She became very excited. So here we are back in the Mediterranean, the whole catchment. This one tiny ship, 50-ton cargo, had material from the whole Mediterranean. It's a wonderful feeling that this integral of the trade that went on in the Mediterranean was captured at this one moment in time. Well, conclusion. I won't repeat the story, we've got that. I'd like to just end with, first of all, saying Malta to me is special. It's a great joy to be back here, especially on the 50th anniversary of this expedition, which was awfully important for me. It gave me my career. I think it was important for Malta because this is a unique wreck in Malta. This is the only Roman wreck with this richness of material that has ever been discovered. And finally, I'd like to say how much Olli Gulcher played in the whole story. He was the hero. Whenever we had a problem, he would disappear and come back with a solution. I've told you about allocating us his summer villa, making contacts with different people all the time. We turned to him and the answer was, yes, I think I know somebody can help or somehow to do it. And so I'd like to dedicate this lecture to Olli Gulcher. Thank you. May I just make one final remark? I know you all want to rush off and get your supper. I want to read a letter that I received just before starting out from the commanding officer of the Mediterranean Fleet diving team. Dear sir, blah, 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 your plans for an underwater archaeological expedition to Malta are most interesting, but I'm afraid I must dash your hopes right away by telling you that the Maltese waters are absolutely devoid of any items of archaeological interest whatsoever. It goes on for two pages. Luckily, I wasn't put off. And thanks to John here.
Right, and thank you very much on behalf of the whole audience here for such an interesting lecture. I just want to say one thing. You remarked that the material from the wrecks at Shlendi has not been studied. I must say that a lot has happened since 1960s. Some for the worse. The environment at Shlendi has gone for the worse. I don't want to anticipate, but you'll be disappointed at what you'll see in Shlendi. But some other aspects for the better. Since that time, archaeology has been taught at the university. It has been introduced as a teaching subject, and we have been training many students who now occupy the key positions in Heritage Malta, the superintendents, and a lot of studies have taken place, including master's research projects for master's degrees. And one of them, taken up by a certain Ms. Azzopardi, I don't remember her first name, she might be here, but she goes,
Elaine
Azzopardi, she dedicated her research, her master's research, on the material from Schlenly. There were a few items that I supervised that dissertation. Some material was familiar, but several others I don't remember. So they might still be in the museum collection, and therefore they still need a study. I just want to say that there is probably an 8th century span between the earliest material amphoras discovered, Punic, and the latest ones, probably 4th century AD. In the last slides, there was an amphora which is about that size, which is typical of the 4th century. So it's not one shipwreck, it is several shipwrecks over hundreds of years. Thank you.
Well, that's a great pleasure. Now, may I make a remark? First of all, I'm a physicist, so I make no pretense to have any archaeological expertise. I searched the web back and forth for reports of an analysis, and I missed that MSE. I would love to have a copy or a reference to it. Okay, he kept it secret from me. But it's very good news. Do you think there's still scope for more work?
Yes,
wonderful. Thank you.
May I just ask, do you find any human remains?
No.
None at all? No.
The question was, were there any human remains? I think we have to remember that it's a small open boat. And if it's sinking, you tend to get out and swim ashore. If you make it, good luck. If you don't, well, it's not, but you're not going to have human remains on the bottom, I don't think.
It is quite clear that the wreck is Roman and not at all Punic. Carthaginian.
That was the advice, that was the conclusion that was drawn 50 years ago by Joan Duplat Taylor, Virginia Grace, and David Trump. Now, Joan Duplat Taylor was an expert on the Bronze Age. David Trump had continued the work on the prehistory of Malta that Evans had begun, his professor. And Virginia Grace was the expert, and she was consulted, and this was their opinion at the time. I stand to be corrected by further research.
Yeah, you kind of drew this poignant picture of these soldiers sort of watching this boat going down with the sort of mail from home and stuff like that.
This is a fun talk.
Yes, I know. No, but on a more serious note, what leads you to believe that this was in fact a victualling operation? It was a supply operation specifically meant to supply a garrison in the area. Because obviously, if this is the case, it would have implications of some consequence, because we normally assume that the island was still reasonably self-sufficient in food until fairly later.
The ship was there.
Yes, but it not, for example, the arch example is St. Paul. He wasn't coming here. It was just bad weather or whatever, which caused the ship, supposedly, to be shipwrecked there. So why does one assume that it is actually, in fact, a cargo meant for the island rather than a vessel which was blown, of course, and simply wrecked offshore?
As I said when I was giving that part of my talk, this is the story that we put together in meetings in the Norman House with what we had available to us. And I'm sure with further research, with further ideas, this is 50 years ago, one may come up with a different story. What I'm doing is reporting what was available to us in 1961, and that was the story that came together in our discussions. Now, one can have different stories.
Perhaps, if there are archaeologists here, at least a number of them, perhaps they could tell us whether there more work has been done, which actually clearly shows that the shipwreck or shipwrecks, that these are, this is not a case.
But obviously, as you said, it's not one shipwreck, but many. So it could have been anything. So the assumption that it is a, first of all, the assumption that it's a Roman ship. Most transport for Rome was actually undertaken by non-Roman merchants and mariners. So it becomes complex. The picture must be somewhat more complex than the one which one would sort of perhaps conjure after a couple of jars.
Well, I have no comment. Of course you're right. But if one wants to give a lecture, one has to have a story. Well, in preparing for this lecture, I went back to my surviving papers, and I have 50 sheets, one for each of the artifacts brought up, saying where it came from, what depth, and so on. Copies of those are in the, well, were in the museum, and also each artifact had a tag on it saying which one it was and where it came from. I haven't been to the museum for 50 years. I look forward to seeing what the state is and discussing it with the curator.
We will need from copies of your.
I'm happy to.
Documents,
yes.
I am sure they're not there. The problem is today, but it will be.
Okay. Well. I mean, I have moved around from England to Germany, back to England, in Italy now, and amazingly, those documents survived. So, and I have them with me here in Malta.
In 50 years, we had many different directors.
No, but I have that material with me, and I was planning to donate it to the museum.
Ever published, drawn up and published?
There was
a report.
I wrote a short report at the time, but we haven't had a complete and proper. It seems it's about time 50 years later to write up at least my bit of it. Maybe I'll work with John and we can do a joint one. But that will merely be a snapshot in time 50 years ago. The professional. Well, I don't know. There is a master's report, thesis on this, which I haven't seen. Is it on the web?
A copy in the literature section, the special section of the university.
Yeah, okay.
And we have a copy in the Bible.
Great.
So you're welcome.
I'd love to see it. So there are, but I must admit, it's about time to write up the story of the 61 expedition, and I plan to do that as a bit like the lecture, as a photographic one. I shall play down the story about exactly what the ship's captain had for breakfast.
Professor Woods, thank you very much. Thoroughly enjoyed the lecture. I'm particularly interested in the lead anchor stocks, the anchors. You mentioned, and I saw a picture of a very small one, and you mentioned that I think somebody else found another one in the area. Yes.
John found a much larger one.
Was it bigger, John?
Didn't you say that yours was smaller than mine, therefore it must be bigger?
Were there any inscriptions on them?
I also found one of those lead things that you know, the flutes.
Yes. The one that holds it together. Was that big? So it must have been a pretty big anchor.
Precise archaeology, no.
Yes. Were there any inscriptions on any of them?
This is the one we found, and interestingly, the lead had been cast on a wooden former, and the wood was still there. Quite amazing. I mean, I was surprised to find wood from that time that had been underwater for centuries, and there it was, and that's the smaller one that we found. The larger one. That John found is here. This is it. You see, it's a big one, and I think you have a reconstruction of that.
I do.
which I don't have with me.
On my memory stick.
Yeah, so two anchors have been
found. No inscriptions on them.
No
inscriptions on them. Nothing embossed coming out of the lead.
I didn't look.
One other question. You mentioned that the divers went down to 60 meters, spent 10 minutes bottom time, and 20
yes.
minutes decompression.
Yeah.
Did you have any diving incidents? Were there any bends?
No. No, I mean, I was very concerned about that. I think it was partly because we were using apparatus where our air consumption was much less than normal, the normal air apparatus, and the fact that we weren't swimming. We were using the electric tugs to take us down and back. So our air consumption was way below what it would have been if we had used the normal conventional sports apparatus and swum. And I think that must have contributed to the
fact
we never had
any. 20 minutes is very little on 10 minutes, 60 minutes.
We had an arrangement with the clearance divers, the fleet divers in Manuel Island, that if we had a problem, we could get a chap back with a helicopter there. In fact, I did land in Manuel Island with a helicopter one day and caused panic because they thought we'd got a diver with an accident. I was just landing there as a convenient place. It was near my flat.
One small other observation. At one time you showed a ring made out of stone. That's fairly recent. That's used by fishermen. That's a fisherman's
Somebody
stone.
Told me at the time, and I've forgotten who it was, that such rings are used in
yeah. to bring the nets up when they
so
get stuck.
It seems that was a modern one just lost overboard from perhaps from a fishing boat. It would be nice if a description...
Thousands found it around the island.
If the museum in Gozo could have a description of it to say, that's not part of the Roman, that's something different, this is what it is, so that visitors to the museum could see.
You were using normal air?
Yes.
No mixes?
I don't think they sell them now. It was just a brief period when the company tried out their apparatus for diving, and it worked fabulously, but it never really was marketed.
I'd like to thank you for a most stimulating lecture. Not only stimulated me, but I'm sure all the audience. And thank you very, very much. Let me present you. There we are. This is a photographic record by one of our committee members, and it's full of photographs.
Thank you very much. That's beautiful.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum entitled The Roman Ship Etchlandi 1961-2011. The talk was delivered by Professor John Woods.